Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Ask the Industry Podcast, episode 106. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, TV production. John Plowman, OBE, is a television and film producer who has been producing some of the most iconic comedic TV shows at the BBC for the last 30-odd years. He's worked on shows including A Little Bit of Fry and Laurie, Ab Fab, The Vicar of Dibley, Gimme Gimme Gimme, Psychoville, Little Britain, and so many more. I got him on to talk about the history of comedy at the BBC, how to get your show noticed, what the BBC is currently looking for, how technological changes are impacting the BBC internally, and how he goes about scouting for new acts, talent, and ideas. If you'd like to know more about John, he actually has a new book out called How to Produce Comedy Bronze. There's a link in the show notes. It's a fabulous book all about the writing process and about his career, and it's full of stories and advice. If you click the link in the description, it'll take you straight to the Amazon page. It's an affiliate link, so I get about 10p per every book. Full disclosure on that one. It doesn't cost you any more, though. So if you want to support the show, press that button and you can help me and John out. I'm going to say much more because this episode is jam-packed with information and I just want to get straight into it. But what I will say is, if you're new here, please do hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do consider giving us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. And either way, please consider joining the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast and it's on Facebook, obviously. It's the best place to ask your questions to future guests before we do the recording. But for now, without any more delays, this is John Plowman.
No, obviously I'm a frustrated millionaire and a hugely frustrated comedian. Neither of those things is true. Yeah, no, look, I think the joy of being a producer as opposed to being a performer is that you can tell the performers what to do. or rather, that you can tell them, no, we cannot spend any more money on that. No, we cannot spend any more time on that. And I don't know, maybe it's just you're allowed a certain amount of megalomania.
So you like the control rather than the creativity?
I hope I don't like the control. What I like is the creativity. And I think what I like is that you start with not very much and you end up with something good if you're lucky. And that process is the interesting one. When we did Absolutely Fabulous, which is in a way probably the thing I'm best known for, although I may be not known at all and I may be deluding myself completely. Anyway, when we did that, there would be beginnings of rehearsal weeks that began with first draft and in small typing at the bottom of the page, and I have a copy of this, it says, "Don't worry, no jokes as yet." and the going from no jokes as yet to that was Sunday, and on the following Friday night to have a lot of people laughing seems to me great. That's a lot of fun, it seems to me.
So let's start with Absolutely Fabulous then. When you first saw the two of them performing together, I presume it was live?
The history of Ab Fab goes very quickly and roughly like this. Dawn and Jennifer did a sketch which was called Modern Mother and Daughter, which was Jennifer as a character called Bettina complaining to her daughter, played by Dawn French, who was, as it were, upstairs doing her homework, that Dawn, complaining firstly that she was having a party downstairs and why couldn't Dawn come down to it. So in other words, it's a sort of generational reversal thing. And also complaining that Dawn wants to go to university. And there is a memorable line, "Where did you say you were going, darling?" "Aberdeen, Mum." "Aberdeen? Aber-bloody-deen? I don't know anybody in Aber-bloody-deen." And it's kind of wonderfully, it's a wonderful example of somebody being entirely out for themselves and nobody else. You know, it doesn't matter about your university education. What about my social life? And when you come downstairs, could you apologize and tell everybody you're on a diet, even if it, you know, just horrible. Anyway, so we did that sketch. And then there was a gap, and Dawn and Len adopted Billy, and that sort of took quite a long time. Billy is their daughter. And as a result, Jennifer didn't have much to do and thought, "I know what I'll do, I'll write a sitcom." And so the first I knew of it, well, there are two bits of first I knew of it. One was when Jennifer's agent rang me up and said, "Hello, John, it's Maureen. Now, your guess is as good as mine as to whether this will lead it to anything, but Jennifer's written a sitcom." Actually, I think so. Jennifer's writing a sitcom. And then the next thing was an exercise book arrived with the first episode in pencil. And that was the first I knew of it. And it was extraordinary, not extraordinary as in, hooray, it's a genius of laughter from beginning to end. It was just that I didn't quite get it. I don't mean I didn't get the joke, because it was wonderfully savage and having a good go at the, what one might describe as the vacuousness of people who work in PR and who PR things, as Jennifer says at one point. It was also that it was a world where I just wasn't sure, and this is my problem, not hers, I just wasn't sure whether this was a world Jennifer had entirely constructed or whether it was real. Now, once we started doing the show, particularly once Joanna came on board, we knew sure as hell that it was a real world, as it were. You know, the world of fashion PR is a genuine thing. And what was remarkable, particularly, you know, having sat in rehearsals with Jennifer inveighing, and the rest of us really, inveighing against these people and saying, "Look, she doesn't look after her daughter very well, she doesn't really do a day's work, she, you know, she's an idle, self-loving..." Anyway, so what happened then was, the first people who jumped up and down and said, "This is wonderful, we love you," were exactly the fashion PR people. "Oh my God, you noticed how vacuous we are." Well, no, they didn't say that. But, "Oh my, you know, you've noticed our world, how wonderful." And that tells you something about the human condition. I'm not sure what, but it, you know, that says something, that when you savagely indict people, they go, "Oh, hooray, thank you for savagely indicting me. It means you've noticed."
Yeah, from my experience of live work is groups of people actually like the jokes about their group of people,
yes,
generally
of course.
Speaking.
Yeah, and no, so that's right, but it's slightly different. It's maybe slightly different to say, "We're doing a joke about your job, isn't that funny, don't you enjoy that more than a joke about somebody else's job?" And to say, "Your job is pointless."
I'm sure they know.
"And you look after your children bad." That was what was remarkable. Almost within two or three episodes, people were claiming, the Daily Mail claimed that they absolutely knew who the models for Edina and Patsy were. I think Patsy was Janet Street Porter. I can't remember who Eddie was, But then a woman popped up and said, no, I'm ready. A PR lady who'd done PR for Dawn and Jen.
Sorry. She was PRing herself there. She was saying, I just want my name.
Oh, it's me. Oh, I see. So you're the person who's admitting as soon as possible that you don't look after your daughter, you don't do good day's work in your life, you're entirely idle and pleasure-loving. It seems to me bizarre, you know. Why not crawl away into a corner and hope nobody ever notices?
Yeah, definitely. So when you read the script, let's put a date on it. So it was around, when was the script done?
We did the first episode in 1991, I think.
So it would have been maybe a year or two before
that. Yeah. No, 6 months.
Yeah. So, well, that...
Maybe a year. No,
that's another
right.
question
Sorry.
To it.
Who cares?
Well, no, so I'm thinking if it was 1990...
Yeah.
There wasn't as much... I mean, there were great sitcoms then, but I feel like there's been a boom in the last kind of years, especially on American TV shows, of just sitcoms getting... No, go on.
It's interesting, isn't it? I've just written this book, and one of the complaints that I make in it is that there isn't as much comedy on television as there used to be. I looked back at the Radio Times for 1993, I think it was, maybe, you know, around that time. And between 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock, most nights of the week, Monday to Friday, there were two comedies. Now, they may not have been very good comedies, but they were on BBC One, 8 o'clock till 8.30, 8.30 till 9. And that's, even if they're terrible... That's good because it means, A, writers are getting good practice at writing sitcoms, and B, actors are getting good practice at being in sitcoms. And now there are far fewer. And there's a sort of feeling of, oh, well, it'll be okay because comedy's on BBC Three or ITV2, and where actually on ITV2 particularly it's bought in. Lockstock and Barrel from Family Guy. You know, it just seems to me not as good a place now as it was then, just in terms of keeping comedy alive.
Is that
and also not enough money spent on it. Sorry, carry on.
No, I agree.
Carry
on. I agree with that part. but is that because... So I've had a few commissioners on before, especially Ian Coyle from Dave was very open and upfront about being an ad man more than a commissioner, because if he can't sell an ad on a programme, as he's not a, you know, like the BBC, the public broadcaster, he can't really validate making the show. So I wonder whether it's a case of...
Yes. It's confusing. Dave, Bill, Fred, you know, there are lots of channels, some of which are just pure repeats.
Yeah, of course. And UK TV Gold, which is
UK
part
TV
of well.
Gold,
yeah.
From which one gets... absolutely no money, and that's maybe, some might say, as it should be. They
oh, so
should
you don't
be
get
allowed
syndication
to.
Money from that.
Sorry,
no, it's all right. No, it's interesting. No, because that's another thing I was going to talk about later. So I'll bring that up in a sec. But my question was going to be whether A, you're finding commissioners are being more, let's say, cautious about what they take chances on, and especially new writers, because I feel like on the circuit, there's a big, especially as I'm about to go to Edinburgh, there's a big push for finding the newest person, which is kind of code for the youngest.
There's all I would say is that every year there is what I've always thought of as a sort of Edinburgh bubble.
Yeah.
There is a thing that develops and everybody says, oh my God, you've got to see him. And why isn't he on the telly? Well, the answer is because he's actually only got half an hour. He does that half an hour brilliantly, or hour. And he's worked at it and he will have a career. It just may not be tomorrow. And Edinburgh kind of produces that feeling. And speaking entirely selfishly, I would rather there were an Edinburgh bubble about ideas and about writers than about stand-up comedians. But I can't have that because people don't go and pay to sit and watch writers write. And rightly so.
Well, there's been, for example, League of Gentlemen, which is some people you've worked with a lot, who
That's
started...
true. And indeed, I still am working with them.
You are still working with them on Inside Number 9.
They've tolerated me this far.
Well, they obviously were doing the Edinburgh Fringe, and did you see them up there? I'm wondering.
I saw them in the Pleasance Attic. Now, the Pleasance Attic, although I wasn't in India when it was ruled by the British, I can imagine that the black hole of Calcutta was something like the Pleasance Attic. It was so hot. It was sort of, it was hot and dark and dense. And on came these three guys, although there turned out in the end to be four of them, these three guys in dinner jackets. And the thing I remember particularly was a tall one telling a story about exploring in a cave, which gradually becomes something about the death of a child in a cave, and maybe this person being responsible. It's a very good piece of writing, and indeed there were lots of other pieces of writing, and there was you know, Edward and Tubbs and lots of the other characters, I think including Pap Lazarou, but forgive me if he wasn't there. And it was like a wife of mine. And they were that year's bubble, but rightly so. Well, no, that's not fair. I mean, I'm sure rightly so for everybody else who's ever been a bubble.
Well, I'm wondering, when you saw them live doing an hour, did you think, I can turn that into half an hour for TV?
I tell you what happened was a radio producer, I think she was a radio producer then, had said, look, we must do something. Come and see these guys, because they're really good. And I think I know what I can do. And obviously, if you're running a comedy department in some shape or form, what you adore is somebody coming up and saying, I've got an idea, and we'll do it this way. Because then you don't have to go through that thing of, well, how, you know, could we do it like this? Should we do it like that? Will it work? Maybe. She wanted to do a thing with the league that was... And Sarah did actually say this, it'll be a bit like The Archers. It was the notion that the sketches would take place all in the same village, which in the initial series on radio was called Spent, and then when they found out the real name of Roy Chubby Brown, was called Royston Basie. And so she... and she was a very good producer, had an idea of what the end product was going to be, you know. So the joy was seeing some new people and thinking, yes, I can absolutely see how we're going to do that, and it'll be great.
So it was like creating a vehicle for them. So you were like taking what they were doing already and putting it...
Well, I think what you always hope to do is to find a way of using comedy sounds stupid, but to find something that fits the comedy that's being done. Does that make sense? In other words, you know, probably the first version of this is the Lucy Show. Lucille Ball was a wonderful, energetic, madcap, slapstick, brilliant, red-headed American comedian. She didn't have her own show. They found a show which was about her and her husband and her best friend. And suddenly that sort of works. You know, you believe the relationships. You believe it generates gags. You need a form. Maybe that's really all I'm saying, that it's good to find a form that fits the material.
I feel, I might be wrong, just looking at your back catalogue, I feel like a lot of the shows are kind of star-led, but like if you removed, for example, League and tried to put in another sketch group, it wouldn't work. So you've made a world, or you've developed a world with them that would only work with them. And I feel like that's the same with all of the sketch shows that you've worked through.
Worked through, is it? Sorry. What I'd put it the other way around and say, okay, that it's quite difficult, not impossible, and I hope I've done it from time to time, it's quite difficult to get to persuade channel controllers to give you the money to make a series without stars. In other words, they prefer the idea of a show that has some people that the audience know in it. And I think, to a certain extent, the audience do. Mm. Now, there are exceptions, and curiously, the League were an exception. But the joy was, the idea was jolly strong, and you could immediately sort of see what it was.
Has that become more the case like in your career? Like, has it become more that they're only looking for stars? Because again, that sounds...
No, I don't. I think it's just it totters along. You know, we did, and you always have to. Sorry, I'm thinking and trying to talk at the same time. It's you know, sometimes you have to ask yourself, why are people stars? It's not just because somebody came along and paid them a lot of money and gave them a nice house and got them on the, you know, into the tabloids. It's because they're good. So the reason Dawn French was cast in The Vicar of Dibley was because she was good and she was right for the part. And indeed, I remember during the early days of rehearsing that show, Richard Curtis, and to a certain extent me, but more Richard, saying to Dawn, never forget, we've got a list, you know, which was essentially, we've got a list of other people who could play the part. It wasn't sort of, it didn't start off as a, you know, what can I write for Dawn French? It started off as, what can I write about this ludicrous idea that it's tough for women to be vicars? You know, that's... So sometimes people work because they're good. You know, when I worked with Mel Smith and Griffiths Jones, it wasn't just that they were stars. In fact, I say just, I shouldn't say that at all. It wasn't that they were stars. It's that they were very good sketch comics.
So, yeah, because from an outsider perspective, it looks the other way around, so I can understand.
I know, and it shouldn't. And the only bit of it that sort of does is when you walk into a controller's office and you say, good news, I got you another series with whoever it might be, and they've heard of whoever it might be, and they go, oh, hooray.
Yeah.
I won't have to worry about whether that show will work. But I would say, and I don't mean this to denigrate anybody else, but in a way, the shows that I'm personally proudest of are the shows where we started with almost nothing, or rather, not a big star base, where the show becomes the star. You know, there was a show we did a while ago called Beautiful People, and Beautiful People came, we did two series, it was written by Jonathan Harvey, and it came about in the way that shows are supposed to but never do. I read a book and I rather liked it, and I bought the rights, or the BBC bought the rights, I personally didn't buy them. We bought the rights, and it was set in, it was about a man called Simon Doonan. Simon Doonan was born and brought up in Reading, God help him, and then relatively soon went and worked in New York and became the creative director of Barney's Department Store. Now, Barney's Department Store is a sort of big fashionable store. Now I'm going to get this wrong, but it's in the middle of New York. Can't exactly remember where it is. Anyway, Simon, small boy from Reading, grows up, becomes a fashionable thing because he sort of wanted to go and live with the beautiful people. And anyway, read this book, thought it was jolly good, bought the rights, and thought that the person who should write it was Jonathan Harvey, because Jonathan, I'd been working with Jonathan on a show called Gimme, 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 and which incidentally was the only show I've ever worked on where we had to turn down the laughter, where I went into the sound department and said, could you bring the level of the laughter down and the actors up? Because, anyway, for the best of reasons. Sorry. So, bought the book, went to see Simon and with Jonathan, Jonathan who'd written Gimme, Gimme, and I persuaded, and indeed, he didn't take much persuasion, that he should write this, but that we should also change it. We should change it. It was set originally in the 1960s, and a cynic would say, I thought, that'll be expensive. But a creative person, such as I was, would also say, it'll make more contact with the audience if it doesn't feel like you're forever thinking, oh, look at those, I don't know, look at those loon pants. If you're just thinking about... Anyway, cut a long story short, Jonathan wrote it. It was really good. And we cast a relatively unknown cast. Olivia Colman was in it. And I remember the casting director at the time saying, get her while you can. And now she's queen, you know. Is there no end?
Yeah.
So in a way, that show was entirely unknowns. And it's the only show I've ever done, with the exception of the film, that had a soundtrack album. And in a way, I'm pathetically proud of a soundtrack album, which includes an ABBA track sung by Kylie Minogue and Danny Minogue. Not saying they were in the same studio at the same time, but they did sing together. Sorry.
That's all right.
That's a diversion.
No,
that's
fine.
What's a diversion from? Stars. I don't know. I mean, it seems to me stars usually are stars because they're good, and you want good people in your show.
Hmm. But I'm wondering, because there's a lot of people who have come up with you and through your career that you've started working. No?
I'm saying that in a slightly yes, all right, yes.
You've got to remember, from my perspective, the shows that I've watched.
Brenton Saunders,
a lot of the shows that you've made, I've come up through, because it's sort of been 19s and, you know, noughties and all that sort of
noughties.
Stuff. So from my perspective, it looks like the shows are pushing the careers forward of those people.
I guess they're doing both, you know, but you try... you try always to get the best people you can, and you try always to try and make the show the best that it can be. And if that means that somebody who a few of the audience know on episode one and all the audience know by episode six, you kind of go, well, that's great, we've done our job. But...
So is it the byproduct, or is it the result that someone who maybe is unknown would become famous?
It doesn't always happen, but quite a lot of times it does. If you put somebody in a leading part, in a show that makes people laugh, and enough people watch it, and that's maybe the crucial thing, or at least watch it over time, then the person whoever the person is, will become a star. And sometimes people feel like stars even when they're not. So when Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant came into my office and said, we've got this thing called The Office, neither of them were known. I mean, Stephen had just done a BBC training course, who cares? And Ricky had worked in the music industry. But they had the confidence and an aura that it was, as it were, they felt, we've already won the Emmys, thank you, even though we haven't made the show yet. You know, there are people who just have that.
Mm. And did that, was that nice or was that annoying? Because I imagine sort of arrogant twin people who, like, have no CV in an industry going, we've got this thing, where's the budget?
I'm talking really more about aura than actuality. Okay. In other words, they came in, they were two people, mostly...
Did you invite them in?
Quite.
How did that work?
I think I invited them in.
Because was this in the days when... They didn't just wander in
off the corridor.
Well, no, because there was a time where there was like open writers' rooms.
Well, you try.
So
yeah, but that... Normally, if you want somebody to make a show or to come to go to a controller and say, please give us... £250,000 an episode. Usually they make an appointment.
Yeah, I was going to say. Seems reasonable.
Yeah, it does, really, doesn't it?
So what's the difference for you, like the main differences in trying to pitch shows or pitch ideas even in a public broadcast to maybe a commercial vehicle? Did you have much to do with BBC Studios, for example, like that sort of commercial wing of it?
A little bit, and I've also worked for ITV.
Mm.
And curiously, I'd say the BBC... I mean, I started at Granada, which was part of ITV at the time.
Mm.
And I'd say the shock was that when I worked at Granada, nobody really cared about ratings or how shows did. And when I got to the BBC, which you would have thought would absolutely be the people who didn't care because they were publicly subsidized and the whole lot, they were the people who did.
Mm.
But that just may have been... my experience and accident and all the rest of it. Sorry, what was your question?
Well, can I interrupt you for a second? Because clearly there's more content than ever now. and there's more pull factors for your eyeballs and your ears.
But so I'm curiously, there is less primetime comedy. And I'm not entirely convinced that the great British public has decided that it doesn't want to laugh as much as it did. Now, what the broadcasters have decided is that drama is king, and that drama should get a lot more money than comedy, and they've also decided that comedy is risky, and therefore you put it on small channels where it just might push through. But of course, it's harder to push through on a small channel than it is on a larger channel. You know, this isn't nostalgia, I promise. Well, it probably is. But when the first episode of Absolutely Fabulous on BBC Two got 7.7 million on a Thursday at 9 o'clock, who cares? Now, if you get a million now on BBC Two, you're thrilled and you think you're doing okay. And indeed, if you ever got 7.7 million, certainly during the week, for a new comedy on BBC One, you'd be, you know, balloons would be being blown up. So the landscape has changed. And the landscape has changed, I think, to the detriment of allowing people to laugh.
But do you think that's down to the taste of the certain commissioners that are in place now? Or do you think they're listening to audiences and maybe it's a case of they actually do want drama at that time? I mean, I would prefer it if they had more comedy, if I'm honest with you, just from a selfish point of view, both career-wise and personally. But I'm playing devil's advocate on this right now because their job are on the line, so they obviously want to produce the best thing that will pull the most eyeballs.
I think what I'd say, and I have no... I mean, look, there's obviously an element of truth in what you say. A controller's job is to keep the job as long as they want it and not to be fired because ratings are terrible. I can see that. And I can see...
As long as we're agreed on that one.
Yeah, and I can see...
Was that what you were trying to do when you were...
I was trying to get fired. And I can see that if you... I can see that comedy is risky, and comedy by and large is riskier than drama, because what drama does is it tells a story. And if I sit down and I tell you a story, I've got that ambition, and if you get to the end and you find out who married who or who killed who or why, then you're happy. Mm. If I say, I'm now going to tell you a very, very funny story and you're going to laugh a lot, and you don't, you feel terribly disappointed. Mind you, I don't feel too good, but you feel very disappointed. And so I think I'd say that comedy is harder. I mean, you know, there'll be a lot of drama people who will say, you should be so lucky. And they'll be right to say it. But somehow, I think maybe drama is easier, and the comedy, because there is less comedy, there has been less chance for comedy to grow. And comedy takes more time to grow than drama. If I start a series in which somebody gets murdered and somebody walks into the room and says, now what's been going on here? They're clearly a policeman. You haven't got too much. You know, and if by the end of the hour or the end of the 6 hours they find out who did it, that's great. But it took more than 3 series for Only Fools and Horses to be a hit. You know, it just takes a while for the audience to get to know the characters, for the audience to sort of enter the world of the show, for the, you know, there's
emotional investment.
Emotional investment, but also even, you know, something as boring as repetition, you might say. You might say, if you see Del Boy screw up something 2 or 3 times, you might think, ooh, lovely, he's going to screw something else up. You know, if you see Idina fall downstairs two or three times, you think, oh, hooray, or maybe you think, oh, God, she's doing it again. There she goes, falling down. So, you know, there's something repetitious about comedy, but not immediately repetitious.
Right.
So, in other words, I think, although I think comedy needs to be given more of a chance, maybe, than drama, but I can see that drama is a quicker and easier... there is a quicker and easier chance that it'll be successful.
So it's more... maybe it's a generational thing that my generation is quite instant gratification-y, which means... That's not a real word, but I'm going to go with it. but we do like our instant gratification, and we like things quick. So I'm thinking...
Yes, but you also like a laugh.
Yeah, but... No, but what I'm saying is, if you... No, but... If you've got a lot of drama programs that mean by the end of the show, I feel good, I can get on with my life, and I don't have to watch another one if I don't want to, kind of thing, that might be more appealing to the current audience that are watching TV than, sort of jump... Because I know, for example, that I don't invest... If I'm going to watch a new series of TV, I'll do it in September when I've got loads of free time. It's after Edinburgh and I can binge watch it if I enjoy it. I don't start watching it
now.
You know,
that's why the autumn season starts when it does.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I imagined. Because, if, for example, I've had a friend of mine who keeps telling me to watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is a program in America.
It's very good.
It's very good. And now I'm stuck on it and I can't watching it.
No, I like it a lot.
But it's so annoying because I don't want to get committed to a show at this point in the year. And it's annoying.
Don't worry, it'll still be there in the autumn.
Yeah, but I won't care because I want to watch it
yes,
now.
Yes, you will. Because if you watch a I'll
watch
half
it again.
Hour,
yeah.
At the end of which you feel, oh, hooray, that was nice.
Those yeah, I binge watch. Yeah. But my point is, it's a combination of questions, but I suppose it's, how is the technology changing the way that shows are being made and when they're being produced?
I think the big change is numeric. The big change is that there's more stuff than there ever was. And therefore, it's, you know, I am old enough to remember a time when there was BBC One and BBC... Now, I can remember BBC Two starting, but all right. There was BBC One, and then there was ITV. Hooray. And ITV was a bit more downmarket than the BBC, and the result of that was it pulled the BBC a tiny bit downmarket. That was the sort of the way things went. And then BBC Two came along, and then Channel 4 came along, and then God knows how many other channels came along. So it's harder, you know, when you start... When there are a small number of channels, it's easier to get an audience to those channels, even the ones that aren't as good as the other ones. When there are seven channels, or when there are 70 channels, it's hard, because why are you going to watch that at that time and not that other thing? Answer, because... the answer used to be because that's all that's on. But if there are seven other things, it's harder. That's really what I'm saying.
But also there's, I suppose...
And I apologise for being inarticulate. Carry on.
That's okay. I'm going to edit. It's going to sound really great.
Thank God.
But did you just think this is going straight out the door? I think collective viewing experiences still happen, but just intermittently depending on the event.
But you say collective viewing experience... slightly as if it's a collective thing. I don't think it's about a group of people deciding they want to watch something. I think it's just that more and more people end up watching something because they've heard it's quite good. You watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I've watched Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Suddenly that show is sort of in the comedy, furniture. Can you be in furniture? Anyway.
Depends on the furniture.
It's part of the comedy television furniture. But it started in Britain relatively obscurely, and it took a while. Witness the fact that you can now see, if you want to sit down and binge watch, three series all one after the other.
Mm.
And that wouldn't have happened in the old days because there wouldn't have been three series available.
No. No, I think stuff like iPlayer and Netflix have made it...
and make a big difference.
Cheaper and easier for you to watch.
And if Only Fools and Horses started now, give or take, it would probably have a bit of an easier time because it wouldn't be so long between Series 1 and Series 2 and Series 3 and the time at which everybody said this is the best thing on telly.
Mm. So in your time of producing shows, when you, we'll tell you what, you can pick a specific example or we can just give a general example.
Okay.
Say you're sat in your office in Television Centre or wherever it is. Yeah. And well, when
in
you
the
were,
days when there were desks and chairs in Television Centre. Sorry, carry on.
That's all right. So, okay, we'll paint a picture for people. 10 years ago, you sat in a Television Centre at a desk and it got a chair.
And it's got a chair, it's got a telephone.
And
it's got all the lock-ons. A secretary outside. Now, none of those things. Anyway, carry on.
So, and you need to make a show because that's your job.
Yeah.
Right. Do you put a call out to agents and say, we're after ideas? Or do you people send you in scripts? Do especially at this point,
well,
you're
a bit of everything. If you're the head of a department, what happens is roughly as follows. The day you walk in the door, there probably are already, you know, let's say 3 series in various stages, either of being on air and another series is coming, or being about to be on air and being good enough to get, you know. So there's a sort of, there's a certain amount that's already given. So what do you do then? You sit down and you talk to some people and some people talk to you and you look for new things. And those new things may be, well, for example, when I started working as what was initially called head of broken comedy, and then I decided that being head of anything that was broken was probably a bad idea, and I became head of, I think, comedy entertainment. Right. Who cares? Anyway, when that happened, the alternative comedy boom, whatever that is or was, meant that I probably didn't think, now, I must work out what to do with the best club comedians that are around. You know, that area had gone out of fashion, so I wasn't looking to do that. And anyway, the entertainment department were doing Little and Large, so, you know. So, I'm looking at a world that has Alexis Sale and Dawn French and Rick Mayall and Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry, you know, that's the world we're working in. And to a certain extent, what you do is you invite those people in and you give them a cup of tea or coffee and you say, is there anything you want to do? And they say, no. And so you say, well, it would be nice if, you know, a conversation happens.
But thank you for the coffee.
Yeah, exactly. No, we're not. And anyway, we don't want to work for the BBC. No, so a certain amount is working with them. A certain amount is going to them with an idea because, I don't know, this is a quick example. I knew in 2010 that the Olympic Games were scheduled to happen in 2012 in the UK. And I thought it would be a shame if we don't do something mildly amusing. And so...
Aim high.
Yeah, aim high.
Yeah.
Go under the...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Go for just...
And so I rang the only person I could think of at the time who knew how to play football, and that was a man called John Morton, because he played five-a-side football every Wednesday. As apparently, I seem to remember, did John Burt, but anyway, let's not bother. So I said to John, what do you think? Do you think there's anything to be done? And there was a bit of a legal nightmare between us and an Australian bunch of people who suddenly thought that I was asking them to do... that I was asking some Australians to do a show about the London Olympics, which would have been fairly insane. Anyway. The long and the short is, John went off and wrote 2012. So in other words, a bit like, I don't know, 15 years earlier, Richard had thought, I want to do the Vicar of Dibley because it's about that you know, it's that time. I want to do that.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Sometimes shows are occasional. Sometimes, you know, we did The Office and it was very successful, and Ricky did what Ricky did throughout his career, or does throughout his career, which is he did The Office for the BBC and then he immediately went off and did a live show for Channel 4 because he believed that he, or his agent believed, that he should spread himself fairly wide. Anyway, and then he came back and said, you know, I've had this thought, we want to do extras. And so, you know, you'd be insane if you stood in his way. I don't mean that you don't add to the idea or at least talk the idea through, but it's a good idea. So things happen in different ways.
Okay. I was going to ask a follow up question to that, but I don't feel like
it's... Go on. I'll see if I can.
Singers are already here.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of an offshoot to what you just said, where you said that your title changed, and I know that you've also been head of comedy.
Oh, but it was only just... I mean, when I say my title changed, what I mean is the bit of paper on the front on the door of my office changed. That was all.
Does it? Yeah, I was going to ask whether these titles meant anything at the in terms of you or.
Disgust. Does your job mean anything?
No, it's fine. Just the time.
I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
But we'll be on
I tell minute. You, okay. What I think, as far as I remember, it went like this. When I'd known a guy called David Liniment at Granada, and we'd worked a bit together on various things. He then came into the BBC as... I think he was head of everything. No, he wasn't. He was head of entertainment, which was entertainment and comedy. And he knew me, and so he said, you know, do you fancy coming in and doing comedy entertainment, which essentially meant shows that weren't mainstream sketch shows. Poor old... no, that's not fair. Jeffrey Perkins, who I say poor old because he had the tougher job, he had the tougher job of trying to provide mainstream comedy hits for BBC One. And sometimes that meant controllers deciding that the only thing to do was to do as little comedy as possible, because then the risks were slightly less, I suppose. And sometimes it meant, and it seems to me that this is the better idea, but what do I know, that people said, well, look, if it's tough to get hits with comedy, we'll just do as many as we can, and if some stick to the wall, hooray. And it seems to me that that's a sort of better idea, really. You know, just to do as much as you can and see what works. I know.
That's pretty much my career up to date.
Yeah, exactly.
Look how well that's going.
Exactly.
Okay. How do you scout for new talent then? Like when you're trying to find people that would go into shows or into ideas, do you go to Edinburgh to the festival? Do you go to comedy clubs? What's your?
I don't go to Edinburgh anymore, but that's just because I'm a lazy git.
I don't blame you.
And there's enough people in Edinburgh, it seems to me, just physically. Mm. There are enough people, even when there isn't a festival. Anyway.
You've not seen my venue, my
Anyway, how do we scout for new people? Well, one way is you see somebody and you just go, you know, you hear about people. Agents ring you up and say, I want you to come and see. Actually, that was how I very first saw Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders. Agent rang up and said, come to this, had in fact, I think, been a mortuary in Hampstead, which was known at that point of its life as the New End Theatre Hampstead. Come and see these two girls because I think they're jolly good. And I went and saw them and they were doing sketches. And I have to say, the audience was jolly tolerant. The audience was very tolerant. And I thought they're rather good. And as a result, I think I went to see them because at the time I was producing Terry Wogan's three times a week chat show. And there was talk about whether they would be on. And so then a few years later when they'd done a couple of series but had decided to go in a slightly different direction, I was rung again and asked if I still could remember who they were. Sure. Sorry, that doesn't answer your question, which was...
I just asked how you were. No, I'm my question.
Oh, looking for people.
New talent, yeah.
So you get Dawn and Jennifer, and then Dawn and Jennifer say, I tell you who we want to have in this sketch because she's jolly good, and that's, I don't know, Harriet Thorpe or Helen Lederer. And so some people come in then. And although I don't remember it at the beginning of my career, I'm sure it existed, you employ casting directors. There was a lovely lady called Tracy Gillam who had an office on the comedy floor of the BBC.
Desks?
And very, rubber shoes, no. Really. Big rubber shoes. And she was a casting director, and there was a lady called Jo Buckingham with her. You know, there was another lady called Rachel. You know, there were lots of people, not lots, but there were two or three people who were casting directors. And because I started in the theatre, at the Royal Court, where there was a rather wonderful casting director called Patsy Pollock, who was, I think the expression ballsy would do, about choosing actors. It's good to be able to go and just talk to somebody and say, is there somebody who can do this? And you end up with, as it were, as we did in Beautiful People, with Olivia Colman and with Tracy saying, get her while you can.
But is... So
so the answer to your question is, you see people, you get told about people, people tell you about their friends, you hear about people, agents ring you, casting directors tell you, it's a mixture.
It's a case of being in the general zeitgeist at the right time in the right place.
Yeah.
So there's no real formula for it, really.
But I don't think there is. And neither do I think in a way that there should be. I think it should be of...
meritocracy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or something.
Or
whatever
that word is.
Yeah. No, it should be a meritocracy and it should be a varied meritocracy.
Definitely. Well, my follow-up question to that is where... I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't cynically say, if you're listening to agents, surely they've got a vested interest in someone they've taken on and they've got their own business reasons for taking on certain clients.
Yeah, but I think you learn pretty quickly who the agents are who are ringing you up just because they want that client and to keep that client, let's say, and the others who are good and ring you up because they think the person's right. And the good ones know that you pick your moment. You don't ring too early. You know, you don't ring me or somebody like me and say, there's this girl who's just come out of RADA and she's really, really good and you should see her. they maybe wait a year and see how she's doing before they ring me, because they know they haven't got many shots at it.
Mm.
So you learn, and also the people you're dealing with learn.
Mm. I read a quote in the Telegraph, which I don't know. I never quite believe quotes in
well
the
Well done for reading the Telegraph. Sorry.
It was a friend's account. I didn't pay for the... But,
okay, good.
I don't know. I don't believe quotes unless I see the person's... Or like...
And was it about me?
Yeah, it was
something
you
God,
said.
What did I say?
It was something you said.
Dear God.
You Go said, on. You could look at everything I've produced over the last few years... and analyse it as a very sick man who has a very sick, sad sense of humour and lives a tragic life surrounded by very dominant women.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Was that real?
Can I ask you to tell me what year that was?
Oh, I think it was about 5-6 years ago.
Was it? Hell? Yeah. It was about 25 or 26.
Well, I think they might have rehashed
an interview. Oh, was it? Okay.
It was a collection of the top the 100 people who are the most influential. Okay.
So I know at one point I was voted 25th most important person in British
something
comedy.
Like that. Yeah. You were further down the list than this one.
Okay,
do what all comedians do. The one time they get 5 stars, they just always say it was 5 stars. Yeah.
Was I lower than 25?
No, I don't remember often. Okay. I can look it
Carry
up.
Carry on. Oh, right. Sorry, you were asking me, am I a sad, tragic person?
I've asked you if you're worth anything and if you're a sad man.
Well, look, I would say that I think since... Well, okay, at the time that I was saying that, I think I was mostly doing either French and Saunders or Abfab or Dibley. And you could say that I was... I wasn't dominated by them at all, because they were wonderful and we got on very well. So what you see there is my sad and pathetic attempt at a joke, which in cold print looks useless. But anyway,
as time
went on, I would say that, for example, the work we did with John Morton on People Like Us and 2012 and W1A tended to be slightly more male-dominated.
Mm.
So, and The Office was fairly male-dominated.
Mm.
Thank God it wasn't entirely. But, you know, so I've done a bit with both.
Totally. Well,
and in the middle.
And in the middle, I was going to say.
Not just.
You've covered all.
I have.
But what I was going to say was, there's obviously talks of quotas and demographics, especially at the BBC, of like having like a woman on panel shows and all these kind of, I think mystic misconceptions and rumours of things that channels are doing to add diversity
I think
and equality.
Meg. Sorry.
She was great. And but I was wondering what your thoughts on quotas and
I don't think it's true.
You don't think they're happening?
Well, I think they happen, but I don't think they happen in the sense of somebody doing my job is rung up by somebody above me. I don't think the head of BBC One or the managing director of television or anybody rings somebody like me and says, you've got too many women in leads in your show, you should get a few men. What happens is there's a general feeling that you want a wide range of stuff. You know, it would be insane not to. You know, it would be silly to just have...
Like you said, you want to produce as much as
you
possible
want to
see what's
exactly.
Yeah.
So I distinctly remember there was a guy called Anil Gupta who came into my office just when I'd started and said, why aren't there any Asian sketch shows on telly? Give me some money, he said, which people usually said when they came into my office. Give me some money and I'll show you that there are some people out there who should be doing a show. And so I did, and it led to, goodness gracious me.
Mm.
Now, it wasn't because I got a memo from on high that said, please could you encourage somebody to come into your office and talk about an Asian sketch show. There's just a zeitgeisty thing that says there ought to be some more, you know, you've gone a bit short on dwarves.
Mm. That caught me.
I don't mean that. Please edit that out.
No, I'm leaving that in.
We did Psychoville, and that contained lots of dwarves. Anyway, sorry.
I enjoyed Psychoville. I thought it was amazing. Sorry, why'd you laugh at that?
Well, no, because just because it's in a way not good to remember Psychoville because of the numbers of doors. It did have quite a few.
I never understood that. For me, that was one of my favourite things for the last sort of 15, 20 years. Oh. I thought it was outstanding. I thought it blended genres together very well.
Okay, well, there's an instance of Reese and Steve. Who knows what ever happened to Mark Gatiss, but Reese and Steve came in and said, we want to do something that's a bit more narrative. Mm. We want to sort of do a series, a horror series, essentially, was what they said. And so, they talked about it and we talked about it, and Psychoville was what came out, and it was a joy, and it was partly a joy because the League of Gentlemen hadn't had any other actors in it much. I mean, not in the main parts. Mm. When it was on, and so suddenly we were ringing people up and who were saying, you want me to work with the League of Gentlemen? Oh yeah, that'd be fun. And the story was a very good and solid
whodunit kind of thing.
Well, it was both a whodunit and a who's it from. Mm. You know, it was six people who each got a letter saying, I know what you did. Mm. And that's a great first premise.
Yeah.
For me, it may tell you about me, but for me, the first episode was most memorable for the moment when Steve runs into the hotel dining room and he's playing a man who isn't necessarily as mentally on top of things as he might be. And he runs in and he says, come quick, we've been another murder. And this is a sort of murder mystery weekend thing. And I had come quick, it's been another murder. And then everybody runs through to another room where he said, look, the murderer has written his or her name on the black... I'll start again. Let me get the words right or Steve will kill me.
He's written fuck pig in the own excrement.
He's written the word fuck pig in his or her own excrement. And you ask yourself at the time, is that comedy? What's funny
written
about
down.
That? Will we get away with that is actually what I thought. So, being a fully paid up member of the BBC, I knew that if I got in early next morning and had a look at the BBC duty log, and the BBC duty log is the thing where I rate people from Tunbridge Wells and various other places, ring up and say, "What, dear, take this off my telly, what do you people think you're doing?" And I was absolutely sure that a slightly mentally challenged boy saying he's written fuck pig in his or her own excrement, and indeed seeing it on BBC Two just after 10 o'clock of an evening, would bring out a few naysayers, or worried folk. Not a bit of it. I was entirely wrong. I got in and I looked up 10 o'clock BBC Two, Psychoville, and there was one complaint, and the complaint was as follows. Didn't say dear BBC, but it might as well. Dear BBC, do your researchers do no work at all? Does nobody bother to check that Bristol is not in the county of Avon? It is its own county. And this was because we'd done a caption, a lower frame super, that said that one of the characters lived in Bristol, comma, Avon. Now, we were wrong, and I hugely apologise to every citizen of Bristol and to the person who wasn't offended by fuck pig, but was offended by the fact that we'd misplaced Bristol. But it tells you something about A, the output, and B, the British public.
It's... I don't know what it says.
No, neither do I. But it says fuck pig in his or her.
Yeah, exactly. well, that I'm slightly stunned by their sort of French, not French, sort of AbFab level of just ignoring something and just going with what matters to them more than anything else.
If that what do you mean ignoring?
As in just being so in their own little world that they're focused on just where their city is rather than.
Oh, I see. Yes, I see what you mean. Yes. Well, the people of Bristol are proud of where they live.
Avon, they're very.
And they know that they're not in Avon.
Who would want to be from Avon, really?
Exactly.
That's what we're saying.
Shakespeare, perhaps.
I don't think he wanted to be from there. Travel limitations.
Indeed, he left it fairly early on.
Travel limitations.
Carry on.
My next question was going to be literally just about PC culture, which kind of builds us in nicely to that.
He's a very good policeman. I've always liked his work. Sorry. It's PC right. culture. And what
that reminds me of the joke from their PC world with the Chipmunks and Judy.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Now this is nostalgia. I wonder what you think of PC culture, what you think of when you were in a position where you had to make decisions.
I tried very, very hard to ignore it.
Okay.
Because... I don't know, because it didn't seem to me that my job was to censor stuff, or at least to censor it just because of some outside idea that I didn't fully understand. Now, this may be a good or a bad example of this. We recently did a reunion show with the League of Gentlemen, which... contained a story involving a character called Pop. Pop is, I think, perhaps Lebanese, but certainly from that sort of neck of the woods. And his son runs a delicatessen. And Pop has been in prison for a while and now comes out and feels that his son is a bit of a wuss. And he wants... He wants, as it were, revenge on his son. I think he thinks, I can't remember the details of the story, and I should. I think he thinks that his son was responsible for him being in prison in the first place. Anyway, he arrives in the delicatessen, and he informs his son that, I think what he actually says is, do you know what this is? And the son says, yes, it's a picnic bar. Of chocolate. And it's a picnic bar because in the earlier series it had been a chocolate bar called Maverick, but as is discussed, Maverick chocolate bars aren't made anymore. And Pop tells us that he's going to put as many picnic bars as he can up his son's, I think it's described as up his son's shithole. A shit pipe, I apologise. Up his son's shit pipe. And clearly a look of fear comes into his son's eyes. Now, I was... we were filming this, and I happened to be there. And the producer told... I was the exec producer, who cares? But the producer said, I've had a note from editorial policy about this, who feel... that we are giving undue prominence to picnic bars. And they want us to disguise, I think, I can't remember, it was a disguise the label or don't mention them or something. Now, it seems to me that as a relatively logical human being, not regularly in the habit of putting picnic bars in the aforementioned ship pipe, that... the makers of Picnic are not particularly going to go, ooh, hooray, look at the wonderful advert that these guys from Royston Vasey are giving us. Because the you know, what he's intending to do is not giving undue prominence to a picnic bar. Indeed, he's telling us that he's about to not give undue prominence to a picnic bar. So I said, look, we can't... No, don't do that. Forget the... Now, I'm not blaming the producer at all. I think the producer would have quite gone, you know, we'd have arrived there without me saying that. But I suppose that was a PC thing. That was somebody in the BBC saying, or that was somebody in the BBC reading the script. Firstly, reading the script not in a funny voice. Reading the script not really kind of knowing what the scene would look like, and why should he have? And not, I don't know, it just seemed to me the wrong call. And so we ignored it. And I suspect if somebody in the end had said, you've given undue prominence to the makers of Picnic Pass, we would have done something, though God knows what. We would have very expensively painted out the wrapping when he did it. There was another instance. Well, I don't know whether this isn't necessarily PC or RC or something. There was an, goodness gracious me, became very successful, thank God. And there were a couple on it called the Coopers, and they were two Asian couples who wanted to sort of outdo each other with being more English than the English, and it was a nice sort of reversal idea. And there was a sketch involving them, which involved them going to church and taking Holy Communion. And I think Mira's character had also brought along dip, so that the wafer, which is the body of Christ, could be dipped into a nice, I don't know, lime, something or other. And the wine, which you're given in communion, one of the other characters had brought along his own rather larger bottle. Anyway. So this went out on a Friday night on BBC Two, and it got quite a lot of objection. And I can see that if you're a believing Christian, then the communion is sort of at the center of your belief. And although I wouldn't, I mean, I can construct an argument that says, but that's not what really is being laughed at here. What's being laughed at are these couples who are trying wrongly to out English the English. But anyway, I got a call because it was going to be repeated on a Sunday night, and I got a call from the then controller of BBC One, who said, do you think you could, I think maybe, no, is it possible to maybe cut this out? And it just seemed to me it's always dangerous when people say, particularly, you know, there's a longer argument that's to do with the Asian community have their own beliefs and the Christian community have their beliefs, and are we saying that one superimposes over another or something? Anyway, to cut a long story short, I rang the producer and told him of the phone call that I'd had from the controller of BBC One, and we talked about, was it possible to not to cut it out completely, but to do an edit that made it slightly less offensive. And I think we did do that. And whether that's, I don't know, I don't think that's political correctness, but it may be belief awareness or belief correctness or something. But, you know, television, some of us who make it, I suspect, sometimes forget that it goes into quite a lot of homes. Maybe slightly fewer homes than it used to, because the others are watching Netflix and are watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Stranger Things. But hey,
still not got around to that one.
What? It's quite good.
It's all right. It looks all right. Well, Twitter's obviously a really big focal point for people to have conversations online about things they like and dislike.
So I'm told.
Yeah. I take it from that comment that you don't...
No, I do, actually. And I do partly because it just seems a good way... I mean, this sounds horrible, but it seems like a good way of just putting yourself out there a bit. And when you've got a book coming out, it's a good thing to do for the publisher to say, I promise I'll put myself out there as much as possible.
Yeah. But when you're putting shows out, especially in the last few years when Twitter's become more of a place where people will share those opinions.
And actually, I mean, quite interesting. Am I allowed? Sorry, go ahead. I don't mean to shout you up.
This is about you, it's not about me.
No, it's about Inside Number 9. Inside Number 9, as you know, is a show that usually has some sort of a twist.
Is it the stats about not tweeting during?
Yeah.
Yes, I saw that.
Extraordinary that the BBC had monitored Inside Number 9, because the audience for Inside Number 9 is a kind of Twitter literate bunch, and normally through television programs, doesn't matter really what they are, they tweet in a kind of computerized version of Gogglebox. So they say, what was he in? Oh yeah, he was in that thing. Oh my God, look at that. Oh, you know, there's a lot of that goes on Twitter during a program. And interestingly, they shut up when Inside Number 9's on, and then Twitter like mad at the very end when the twist arrives.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I didn't see that coming.
Well, my day job, I write jokes for Twitter for brands and people and stuff. And I have worked for, like, you know, Discovery
for
TV. For brands.
Like, oh, brands.
You know, like,
I'm
brands
sorry.
That are on Twitter or people. Whatever will pay me, I'll do it for. But if you listen...
Could you write me some games?
Oh, yeah.
Carry on.
Yeah, it's fine. But when I work for TV channels writing their tweets, a lot of the time they would say, we really want to have conversation during the show. We really want it to trend, like we want the hashtag to trend. And I kept saying, but then they're not watching what you spent a lot of money making. It just seems ridiculous. And I remember seeing those statistics, and I've worked with a TV channel since, and it was the first thing I said. I was like, well, do you like this program? Look how much better it is that they're talking about it after you've, you know.
After they've watched it.
Yeah, after
they've consumed it. Yeah, let them watch it.
Yeah.
I don't know is the answer. I mean, some shows feel like they're chewing gum for the eyes, and therefore, if you're doing one thing with your eyes and another thing with your hands, that's fine.
I suppose.
No, fine.
Okay. Quick fire questions.
Go on.
They're quick for me. Take as long as you like to answer.
I have a buzzer.
Okay. What is the biggest mistake you've ever made, and how did you overcome it?
What's the biggest mistake I ever made? Where do we want to go with this? Well, the biggest mistake I suppose I ever made was that the very first program I produced, which I produced for Granada Television, was banned by the IBA. So I'd say that constitutes a pretty big mistake.
And why was it banned?
It's a relatively long story, but it was called An Evening with Doris Stokes. Doris Stokes was a clairaudient. A clairaudient is someone who hears the dead from the other side and relates to us on this side what the dead are telling her. And seemed to me quite a good idea for a television program. And Granada were at the time looking to do sort of edgy late night things. And I knew the guy who was promoting her around the country. And so we constructed this program, which was Doris bringing back the dead, and then 25 spiritualists, 25 punters, and 25 psychology students from the University of Manchester. Because I thought, hooray, hooray, they'll say this is mind, you know, this is playing with our minds, this is nonsense, whatever they would say. They were more enthusiastic about the dead coming back than anybody. They wanted their budgie back. They wanted their auntie back. You know, and it was hosted or adjudicated maybe by a man called Roger Royal, the Reverend Roger Royal, who was a Church of England reverend and used to quite regularly appear on a thing called Pause for Thought on Terry Wogan's morning show. Anyway, it was a relatively camp old festival. Well, no, it was a good festival of something or other in which the dead came back and oh, lovely. Oh, he's coming back with so much love. Anyway, a lot of that went on. And then I got a phone call from the Sun newspaper. Now, at the time, The Sun newspaper, I think, wasn't owned by Rupert Murdoch, but it was still a relative. I should have known better, but I didn't. Anyway, I was rung up by The Sun, and they said, now we hear you're doing a programme with Doris Stokes. Can you tell us anything about it? And I said, well, you know, obviously it's just a local programme, just going out in the Northwest. I can't, you know, so I'm sure you won't be able to do much on it, but it's quite interesting because the dead come back, as it were. And they said, well, I'm not sure we'll be able to do very much on it, but, you know, we might be able to give it a paragraph. And then they immediately put the phone down. I think the man was called Derek. Anyway, Derek put the Derek put the phone down and rang Doris and said, Granada are very worried about your show. Nothing I had said implied that in any way, shape or form, and indeed should have been the opposite. So Doris then gave them a lot of defensive, I'm a good girl, I don't mean no harm to anybody, I don't. She didn't particularly talk like Eliza Doolittle, but anyway. So she gave them some defensive quotes. They then rang a well-known anti-spiritualist priest who said, if God was going to bring the dead back, he wouldn't do it on a chat show. Now, we might discuss, I think, at some length whether he would do it on a chat show, but anyway. So, this led to, and I can't remember, it was like a week later, full page in The Sun that said, horror chat show storm. You know, the dead come back, priests up in arms, you know, whatever. And horror chat show storm led to the IBA, which was the sort of governing body of ITV at the time, saying, we need to see this program, and seeing it and not quite knowing what to do with it. And so sending it down to London to the IBA there, who didn't know what to do with it. So they sent it to the guy who was the head of the IBA at the time, and he said a conversation was had between him and between Granada and the IBA. And they decided again it. Even though I later found out that the chairman of the IBA, I think at the time, and forgive me if this is wrong and or libelous, was the chairman of Capital Radio, who gave Doris a two-hour slot, phone-in slot, every Wednesday evening on Capital. Anyway, my first program was pulled. I got a phone call from Mike Scott, who was the program controller at the time, who said, I'm sorry, it's not going to go out, but, you know, look at it this way. If your first program is pulled, you'll probably end up as program controller. Well, I didn't, but it didn't matter too much. Sorry. No. There's a quick fire.
There's a quick fire answer.
Go on.
Who do you think is the most underrated person in the TV industry?
Me. No. Who's
fair?
No, it's not. It's just...
Okay.
It's a good question. Who's the... narrow it down a tiny bit. Do you mean performer or producer?
I normally keep it quite open on purpose, but if we said one behind the scenes, one in front of the camera? I mean, it doesn't narrow it down, does it? That's basically me giving you categories. That's basically me saying, well, how about if I just split it and then you can pick one of each?
All right. I will pick... and actually, he's not underrated, so this is, in a way, not answering your question, but... Hugh Skinner, who plays Will in W1A, I think he's very good and very funny, and happens also to be, so I'm told, in the new Mamma Mia Horror Fest that is currently in cinemas up and down the land.
Okay.
He's jolly good. And his character, I don't know whether I should be careful telling this story, but there was part of that character comes from a conversation I had with a personnel person at the BBC a long time ago, who said, I've just had this extraordinary encounter with a producer who'd had an intern for, I think, 15 months without paying the intern. And when the producer was confronted, and they said, "Look, you know, you can't do this," she said, "Oh no, it's okay. He's my cousin," which is sort of nepotism and wrong on so many levels. So underrated on screen, Hugh. Not that he is, but he's jolly good. underrated off screen. Well, he again. I was going to say John Morton because he's a genius, and he's only underrated. He's sort of underrated by himself, really. I mean, I think anybody who's ever seen People Like Us or W1A or 22 or whatever knows how good he is and how good he is at a particular thing. And the particular thing he's good at is apparently, so I'm told, called phatic language. And phatic language is a thing we all do, which is how we say nothing. We talk, but don't really say anything. You see, the thing is, obviously, you know, I don't want to go into this, but what I really mean is, you know, that's phatic. That's filling in a gap before saying anything. Mm. And it's what his characters do rather well. And to write it is, I would imagine, hugely difficult.
Yeah.
But he does. So well done him.
Last question.
And Ree Shearsmith. I'd say Ree Shearsmith is hugely underrated because he keeps telling me that he is. No, that's not fair. He's bloody good as well.
Fair enough. Last question. If you could go back and give yourself one bit of advice just as you're starting your career in TV, what would you have liked to have known?
Don't work in television.
Thank you very much for coming on.
That's all right.
That was John. His take on the connection between the Edinburgh Fringe and the TV industry, as well as how viewing figures have dropped and how the industry has had to adapt to that change, along with his advice for new and upcoming writers and performers, was so inspiring to me. As someone who has been working on a few scripts for a while and a few idea-based things, I don't know how to describe them, they're like shorts, I suppose, I really found this inspiring to put together, and I really found it motivating to try and get some more of them finished. So I can't thank him enough for his time, and I really appreciate everything that he had to offer. As I said before, John actually has a new book out called How to Produce Comedy Bronze. There's a link in the show notes, it's an affiliate link, I get about 10p from every book, doesn't cost you any more, so if you could use that link, please do. It really helps out the show because it gives me a small, but if everyone did it, donation. And also it helps out the guest because obviously they put a lot of time and effort into creating a book to help you learn more about the industry. If you'd like to thank either me or John, please do check out our Twitter handles in the show notes of the podcast, or you can search for them if you don't want to do it that way. However you want to do it, please do thank the guest if you've got something out of the podcast. Even if it's one nugget of information, it really helps because then they know there are people listening and there's an audience here, and it means when I ask them for an introduction to someone else, they're supportive of that. So if you can help, please do. It really helps out the show. Also, tweeting me really helps me out because there's a lot of editing that goes into these shows, and a little bit of community support never ever doesn't go a long way. So thank you very much for any of those messages. If you like this episode, you might also like my interview with Chris Sussman from BBC Studios. We were talking about the commercial wing of the BBC, or you might enjoy my interview with Mark Talbot, head of comedy at Hattrick Productions. We spoke about indie production houses and how they scout for new talent and ideas. There's so many episodes you can go through in the back catalogue of this podcast. If you're interested in TV or writing for TV, please go and check it out. If you're new here, please do remember to hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do remember to give us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. And either way, please do consider giving us a donation to keep the project going. As I said a minute ago, about 18 hours, 15 to 18 hours go into every single episode of this podcast. You can donate from as little as £1 or a dollar if you go on Patreon. If you think this is worth a quid, can you afford to help me keep doing this? I'd really appreciate it. You can do it at simonkane.co.uk via PayPal, or you can do it via Patreon from $1 an episode. That's 80p. It's really not a lot of money, and I understand if you can't afford it, but if you've got 80p twice a month to support this show, please do. Please do donate. No matter how small or big your donation, all of it helps. The Ask the Industry podcast is a Fruit That Got in Gravity's Way production for the internet. All elements were created by me, comedian Simon Kane. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for subscribing. And thank you very much for rating and donating if you do. I'll see you all in about 14 days' time. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.